Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International, our weekly program that puts the focus on news and current events in the Asia Pacific region. The Chinese President Xi Jinping on Thursday will become the first foreign head of state to address the Indonesian Parliament. His visit to Jakarta is ahead of the APEC summit in Bali and is his first trip to an ASEAN nation since assuming China's top job. He will later visit Malaysia. Bill Bertels has the story.
Xi Jinping arrived in Jakarta late yesterday, ahead of a hugely symbolic speech in Indonesia's parliament today. It's the first time a foreign leader will address a joint sitting of the parliament. The senior managing editor of the Jakarta Post, Cornelius Purba, says Indonesia encourages China to play a more active role in ASEAN affairs.
China is second most powerful economic power after the United States. But also, we want to see that China can play more responsibility for ASEAN security and welfare.
Unlike many of its ASEAN neighbours, Indonesia doesn't have a maritime border dispute with China in the South China Sea. But Cornelius Purba says Jakarta is still wary of China's growing naval military might.
Indonesia regards itself as a sub-regional superpower. For Indonesia, China, the military build-up is worrying. So Indonesia will never say that openly. But actually, Indonesia agrees with the strong presence of U.S. In this region, without hosting any military base for the U.S.
As usual on overseas visits, the Chinese side is bringing economic muscle to the table. Infrastructure, technology and resources deals worth up to $20 billion have been signed. The Chinese government has also signed a $15 billion currency swap deal to help prop up the Indonesian rupiah, which has lost 16% of its value this year. It's all a far cry from the 23-year freeze on diplomatic relations brought about by a failed communist coup in Indonesia in the mid-1960s. Cornelius Purba says even after normalising relations in 1990, attitudes in Indonesia towards China have remained fairly frosty.
I think there's a kind of deficit of trust to China because we have a long history with China. And again, because Indonesia regards itself as the sub-regional superpower, and China is the threat. So we don't regard China as our best friend, but also China is not our enemy.
Xi Jinping will attend the APEC forum in Bali before leaving for his next stop, Malaysia, one of the countries that does have a maritime border dispute with China. Dr. Oi Kee Beng from the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore says President Xi's diplomatic visit to Southeast Asia is vital for building trust.
Any kind of dialogue or cordial visit is bound to allay some fears.
Those fears of a more assertive Chinese military in the South China Sea has driven many Southeast Asian countries to seek closer ties with the US, prompting Washington's pivot to Asia. But just as President Xi was arriving in Jakarta, the White House announced President Barack Obama would have to cancel plans to visit Malaysia and the Philippines due to the US government shutdown. He's sending the Secretary of State, John Kerry, instead. Dr. Oi says the increasing attention that Southeast Asian countries receive isn't likely to sway them from their long-held goal of balancing the great powers.
We are talking about relatively small countries other than Indonesia, of course. And I think for many decades now, they have come to the agreement that their best bet in international relations is to stick together as far as they can and to balance between all the great powers. And I think that still holds, that there is really no reason to move away from that. Of course, the rise of China has, of course, made the equation slightly more complicated today. But I think the general wisdom still stands that all these small countries have to act as one because they are very small countries and they're liable to be pulled apart if they're not consciously trying to stick together.
Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott has given the Indonesian President fresh assurances that Australia will not violate Indonesia's sovereignty amid ongoing tensions over Canberra's plan to turn asylum seeker boats around. Both leaders spoke at the united and cooperative approach of combating people smuggling, with Mr. Abbott describing Jakarta talks as frank and candid and apologized for past Australian behavior, saying all sides of Australian politics should have said less and done more. Mark Simkin reports from Jakarta.
Tony Abbott and his entourage received a very warm, very loud and very colourful welcome to country. Soldiers goose-stepped, big guns fired, and a military band played on the lawns of the presidential palace. All signs of how seriously Indonesia's taking this trip. The two leaders talked trade, with one particular trade singled out for special attention.
We had very cordial, constructive and collegial discussions on the issue of people smuggling. Much of the detail will be left to further discussions between the Coordinating Security Minister of Indonesia and the Border Protection Minister of Australia. But we are resolved, together, united, to tackle this problem and to beat it.
Frank and candid because senior figures in Indonesia are uneasy about boat turnbacks and boat buybacks.
But I do want to stress publicly as well as privately, Bapak President, Australia's total respect for Indonesia's sovereignty, a total respect for Indonesia's territorial integrity.
The leaders didn't talk about the specifics of Operation Sovereign Borders, but they did make it clear their countries need to cooperate more.
Both people.
We discussed people smuggling and boat people. Australia and Indonesia, we both are countries that have become victims. We have been victims of this act of people smuggling. Many citizens arrive from other countries and give us burden. They give us social burden. They give us economic burden. And when some continue their journey to Australia, that brings more burden. But together, Australia and Indonesia can overcome this issue, and the solution lies in cooperation.
Last night, the President hosted a formal dinner for his guest. In an unusual move, Tony Abbott apologised for mistakes made by both sides of Australian politics.
There have been times, I'm sorry to say, when Australia must have tried your patience, when we put the sugar on the table for people smugglers, or cancelled the live cattle trade in panic at a TV program. There have been times when all sides of Australian politics should have said less and done more.
This morning, Tony Abbott will address business leaders. He's expected to outline initiatives to expand and improve corporate ties. The message will be the same as yesterday's. Australia is open for business.
That was Mark Simkin reporting from Jakarta, Indonesia. A court in Vietnam has sentenced one of the country's best-known dissidents to 2.5 years in jail. Human rights lawyer and blogger Li Chong Quan was convicted of tax evasion, charges condemned by rights groups as politically motivated. Security outside the Hanoi court was very tight, where an unusual large group of supporters protested against the decision. Next, Sen Lam speaks to Marianne Brown, a Hanoi-based journalist.
It's difficult to know because I wasn't allowed access to the court. My colleague was, but nobody was allowed recording devices, and they were given access by an adjacent room via CCTV.
The trial, I understand, took about half a day, and Lee Kwok Kwan himself... Lee Kwok Kwan says it's a political trial because the government did not like his blogs. What sort of issues did he raise through his blogs?
Oh, well, he talked a lot about different cases, individual cases of civil rights. He talked about, for example, activists being harassed by police. And he talked about a lot of different issues because he was Catholic, but he didn't just talk about issues affecting Catholics. He talked about land grabs and he talked about democracy as well. So he really spanned a whole kind of variety of issues.
And his supporters, I understand, protested outside the courtroom. Did that surprise you, not just the turnout, but also that the protests happened?
No, there was a vigil. His trial was originally supposed to take place in July, and there was a vigil at his church, Taiha, which is also in Hanoi. And I went to that, and there was about 1,000 people there, all of the congregation, but not just Catholics, also other activists. So he had a lot of support, and he had a lot of support across the country because he was, you know, one of the best-known dissidents in Vietnam. And there were vigils going on in churches across the country.
And Marianne Brown...
I was just going to say, when I saw, you know, 500 or so people on the street, I wasn't surprised.
Marianne, the media freedom group Reporters Without Borders says Vietnam is only second to China in the number of bloggers that it detained or jailed. Do blogs reach a big audience in Vietnam? Is it a popular source of information and opinions?
Blogs, certainly, yeah. And blogs are really popular. Not always political blogs. I would just say that political blogs are still quite a niche thing, but you've got blogs on all kinds of issues, so, you know, all kinds of topics. And they have been for, you know, more than 5 years, at least.
And, of course, it's not the first time that Le Quoc Quan has been in trouble. He is a known figure to the authorities, isn't he, and indeed has been detained in the past?
Yeah, He was first detained in 2007 when he returned from the States. He did a fellowship at the National Endowment for Democracy, and he was detained for a couple of months. And then released, and then he took part in a couple of anti-China protests, and was also detained briefly at the outside the trial of Khoo Huy Hap Vuu, who was a human rights lawyer.
And Marianne, what is likely to happen to him now, to Le Quoc Quan? Is he likely to spend the next 2.5 years in jail, or are there avenues of appeal?
Well, yeah, his supporters say he's going to try and appeal, so. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen to him? He could be, there could be another trial after that. Maybe he will be charged with crimes against the state. That's what happened to DOK. He was also charged with tax evasion in 2008. And then he was later charged with conducting anti-state propaganda and sentenced to 12 years. But
that was Marianne Brown, a Hanoi-based journalist, speaking with Sen Lam about the sentence against one of Vietnam's most famous and best-known dissidents. China is preparing to name and shame its worst polluting cities in Beijing's latest attempt to rein in what's called being branded as a pollution crisis. This is in addition to moves to cut the use of coal and close steel factories to reduce smog. Now, the government is also planning to subsidize electric and plug-in hybrid cars, but many drivers are proving too hard to convince. Hui Fernte reports from the Chinese capital, Beijing.
The selling point of Tesla's battery-powered car, the Model S, isn't just that it's good for the environment.
The only decision you need to make when you come to one of our Tesla stations is, do you prefer faster or free?
It's also the convenience of having flat batteries replaced in just 90 seconds. This car company wants to do to electric vehicles what Apple did with its iPhone.
So hopefully this is what convinces people finally that electric cars are the future.
The firm has China in its sights. One analyst estimates annual sales here are growing by around 80% every year.
So if we just look at the growth rate, that's amazing. Growth rate that a traditional car can never achieve. So we should be optimistic with the future of the electric vehicle in the long run.
Tesla is on a recruitment drive in Beijing, preparing to enter the market just as the city experiments with this evolving technology. The local government of Beijing wants to implement a city-wide rental scheme for electric cars, similar to projects in Germany and France. But China also wants more of its people to buy them. Over the next 2 years, it aims to promote electric cars and hybrid plug-ins in places that suffer serious air pollution, like Beijing, Hebei, and the Yangtze River Delta. It's part of a broader cleanup plan to improve air quality in the world's second largest economy. Most of the green vehicles are currently used as public transport in China. But people here are put off by the price. Green cars are generally a third more expensive than conventional ones. And even after the government subsidy, an electric car can still cost around 20,000 Australian dollars. 3 years ago, Beijing introduced a citywide license plate lottery in an attempt to ease the capital's chronic traffic jams and in turn its pollution. While electric cars are currently exempt from these restrictions, it hasn't been enough to drive up demand.
E-cars and hybrid cars are rarely seen on Chinese roads. In fact, e-cars are still so new, they're largely confined to spaces like this university, where students and teachers can rent them and zip around campus and beyond.
Recharging is also a problem. There aren't many places where an e-car or a hybrid can fill up. BMW's first all-electric car has a driving range of up to 160 kilometers. And that distance drops if the air conditioning is on as well. But BMW doesn't think that's an issue for the Chinese market.
Whenever you plan to have a longer distance, you might want to use a petrol engine still. I think the whole technology then is not made that you go travel through Australia with this car. I wouldn't recommend. But if you're in Sydney or in Melbourne or in wherever, you have a great fun driving this car in this city area, which is then your daily environment. Huh?
But a growing environmental consciousness among urban Chinese means e-car manufacturers are continuing to invest heavily in research and development. And as the technology evolves, it may win over some drivers in the world's largest car market, who, until now, have remained largely unconvinced.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A large tsunami generated by an earthquake very close to New Zealand would hit before sirens were even activated. That's according to a new report, which also warns New Zealanders that they will experience a tsunami in their lifetime. The report has been prepared by GNS Science for the New Zealand Ministry of Civil Defence and Emergency Management. Campbell Clooney asked GNS geologist Graham Leonard how the report came about and what does this mean for the Pacific.
Well, back in 2005, we conducted our first national tsunami risk review. I guess the Indian Ocean tsunami gave us some good political traction to really understand New Zealand's tsunami risk. Mm. As scientists, we'd known it for a while. So we got a good picture of the main cities around New Zealand back in 2005. And the central government this year has decided it's time to update that picture and look a little more closely at all of the pieces of our coastline. So we've run a review of tsunami hazard, and it came out yesterday.
I think people are probably a little bit surprised to find that, you know, it could happen and it could hit before you even got any sort of warning. How does that happen?
Right. Well, tsunami for New Zealand is a hazard similar to for example, for Japan or to Washington State up in the north of the United States, or Chile, where we've got local big fault lines that can generate tsunami. These are called subduction fault lines, where tectonic plates are coming together, part of the Ring of Fire, right on our doorstep. But we're also exposed to tsunami from everyone else's faults around the Pacific too. So it's the ones nearby that we're most worried about, because the tsunami can get to us within as little as 10 minutes, and a lot of places within, you know, less than an hour from these local faults. And what we've realized, sort of gradually actually over the last 8 or so years, is that that those fault lines can give us really quite large earthquakes and tsunami, very much like what we saw in Japan in 2011.
I remember the last major tsunami issue that we had for the Pacific, 2009, and actually I didn't realise until today, it's actually now the fourth anniversary of that one. It just happened on the 29th. And there was a significant warning that came to New Zealand, and I remember people were moving back from the shore. Is the thing you hear about it happening there, and then you can start doing something about it, but if it happens on your doorstep, there's not a lot of time.
No, and luckily the most important message for all of these countries, especially the Pacific Islands that are near faults like Samoa and Tonga and actually a lot of the islands, Fiji right through Vanuatu, the earthquake is the warning for that local source. So if there's a really big earthquake, that's one that's long or strong, doesn't have to be both, so longer than a minute or difficult to stand up in, you need to evacuate coastal areas uphill or inland and not wait for any sort of official warning. I mean, that was really what saved a lot of lives in Samoa and Tonga following that event you were just talking about. Mm. And it's not until the source is farther away. So Samoa took 3 to 5 or more hours for the wave to get to us. And so we had time for some official warning because we didn't feel the earthquake. So the earthquake is the warning for these local sources, and that's really the point we're hammering home here in New Zealand, and it's a key message for tsunami preparedness in the islands as well.
When you mentioned there that New Zealanders have experienced a tsunami in their lifetime, it would not have to be, I suppose, a major one.
We do mean a damaging tsunami. So we experience tsunami every year or two that we can detect in the order of centimetres. So we were detecting the Japanese tsunami. We detect other earthquakes around the Pacific all the time. But damaging tsunami are probably coming from our local faults 2 or 3 times every century based on the last couple hundred years, and then another couple from across the Pacific as well. So you're likely to see one that actually does some damage in your lifetime and probably more than one.
Your report goes to the Ministry of Civil Defence Emergency Management. What will they be doing with it, and what will we see coming from that?
Well, one of their roles is to provide coordinated information to regional civil defence throughout the country, and those agencies draw evacuation maps. That's the most useful product for the public. So using these wave heights, they can define areas that people need to get out of, and they can draw lines so people know where they're safe once they evacuate after that warning comes, whether it's an earthquake or some official warning. We also, as part of this, updated those earthquake sources and our understanding of how they behave after Japan, and that applies to some work we do in the Pacific too. So not that long ago, in 2011, we did some work in Samoa, helping them with their evacuation maps, mm-hmm. and that took into account some of these larger waves at the time. So that's much more recent work than 2005. So Samoa takes into account those large Japanese size waves, and similarly, other countries we work with, and also we're in discussion with Geoscience Australia, for example, will be taking into account this type of wave modelling in the future.
Liver fluke is a worm parasite which infects a large number of animals across every continent. In Australia, it's epidemic in sheep and cattle herds in southeast Australia. Livestock industries are facing serious economic losses as the disease parasites develops resistance to existing drugs. So the hunt is on to develop a vaccine. With a time frame of about 5 years, Professor Terry Spithill and his team will lead a just-funded research project to develop a new vaccine against liver fluke disease, which incorporates data from bred sheep in Indonesia, which is very resistant to liver fluke. He speaks next to Desley Blanche.
Liver fluke is what we call a worm parasite. It's transmitted to animals. When animals graze on infected pastures, they eat a little infective cyst, which has been released onto the pastures from infected snails. When the animals eat the cyst, the little cyst hatches in the intestine, releasing a little parasite about the size of a pinhead. It penetrates through the intestine, goes into the liver, migrates through the liver for about 8 to 10 weeks, causing damage, hemorrhage, and fibrosis in the liver. And then as the parasite grows from a little pinhead to about 1.5 to 2 centimetres, it penetrates into the bile ducts in the liver, sits in the bile ducts for years and causes chronic problems for animals, including blood loss due to the blood-sucking activity of the parasite. So it's a worm parasite that's transmitted via snails that causes liver damage, and it's the damage to the liver that causes the economic losses, the reduced weight gain, reduced milk production in dairy cattle, reduced wool production in sheep. So it's an insidious parasite in that it tends not to kill animals, it damages animals and causes these hidden effects which show up as major production losses. In very high numbers it can kill sheep and cattle, but that doesn't happen very often. So it's a parasite which is found in Australia, right throughout Asia, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, through Europe and down through Africa. There are two main species, what we call the temperate liver fluke, which is found in Australia and Europe, and the tropical liver fluke, which is found in across Asia, Southeast Asia and Africa. And these two flukes are very, very similar. So the work we do on this, say, a fluke in Indonesia and a fluke in Australia, does inform research on both parasites.
And tell us how it affects those subsistence farmers in countries like Indonesia and China and Cambodia.
I'm very experienced with Indonesia. When we were working in Indonesia 10 or 15 years ago, a typical subsistence farmer would have 4 cattle. Those cattle would be used to plough his fields and sow his rice, what have you. The cattle are also like his savings plan, so as the animals grow, when the farmer needs funds to, say, to fund a wedding or to send his child to university, they'll sell one animal to generate income. So these animals are both production animals as well as their investment for the farmer and his family. So when the fluke infects these animals, when they come to maturity, the animals will be 15 to 20% smaller. Dairy cattle will produce less milk, 15 to 20% less milk. It affects fertility, so the animals are less fertile, so it takes longer for a female animal to become pregnant. And the animals which are infected can't work as well in the field.
Now, these parasites are developing resistance to drugs. Is this the main reason that you're developing a vaccine?
That's probably the primary one. We do have good drugs. The dilemma we have, there's only one drug which will kill the baby parasite. The important thing about liver fluke is you've got to control the parasite early after it enters the liver, before it causes too much damage. So that's what we call the baby or juvenile parasite. And there's only one drug that kills the baby parasite in the first few weeks of infection. And that's the drug which, unfortunately, the parasite is developing resistance to in Australia and across the world throughout Europe and Ireland. And so the problem with drugs, of course, is that it's inevitable that parasites will develop resistance to drugs. So we think a more sustainable approach is to develop a vaccine. We all know how effective vaccines like smallpox and the polio vaccines and measles vaccines are. We believe if we can develop a vaccine, A, it'll be effective, and B, it'll be very sustainable, and C, it's probably cheaper for producers to use a vaccine than to be treating animals with drugs three or four times a year.
And with that, we end this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us with story ideas or to let us know what you think of the show, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, by visiting our website, which is www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. On Sunday at 1330 UTC, you can catch another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Normally it's with Andy Sennett, but Andy is taking a little time off in the UK this week, so this week's show is going to be presented by Dan Hensley, and that's at 1330 UTC Sunday on 11835 kHz. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again in 7 days. Bye-bye.